This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. At the beginning of the new novel, Life After Death, Boyd Schaefer says to her husband, in anger, that she'd prefer him dead. He had just left their 4-year-old daughter alone in the park, and Boyd is not satisfied with her husband's excuse. It's hardly the first time he's lied to her. "I don't want to listen to you anymore," she says. "Do me a favor. Die." The next morning, he does, of heart failure. The rest of the novel is about her grief, her confused feelings, and the subsequent changes in her life. Shortly after author Carol Muskie Dukes completed this novel, her own husband, the actor David Dukes, died of a heart attack. Carol Muskie Dukes is the director of the graduate program in literature and creative writing at the University of Southern California, and the author of 2 other novels and several collections of poems. Let's start with a reading from Life After Death, shortly after Boyd learns about her husband's death.
How many people have screamed, "Drop dead," or "Die and get it over with"? How many husbands and wives have imagined, have hoped for, prayed for, the car crash, the backward arm flapping, drunken fall down the cellar steps, the chunk of masonry plummeting earthward as the front door slams emphatically shut? But how many who have imagined such things, and even articulated them, have picked up the telephone and heard the words that stop time? How many have turned into the driveway and parked behind the paramedics van, its blue and amber lights flashing, and seen the one so recently commanded to die, lying on the ground, dying or already dead in the grass, strange people and machinery attending him. Dead eyes, locked on the eyes of the one who shouted, "Die, just die, will you?"
Thank you for reading that. That's Carol Muskie Dukes reading from her new novel. You know, as you write, most people who think about someone or who say to them, "Drop dead," don't expect the person to die. And in fact, usually that person doesn't drop dead the next day. Why did you want to write about a relationship where the husband did die right after the wife said that?
I haven't prepared myself for that question, but I guess what I'd have to say is that I wanted to imagine a world in which there was responsibility in language, a world in which what you said really counted. So much of what we say doesn't matter, that I wanted to raise the stakes, that is to say, to create a conversation that would be essentially like poetry. And I don't mean poetry in an aesthetic sense. I mean a sense of poetry, that sense of poetry that means every word matters, in which every single word matters, so that my character, this character who says the words to her husband, had to understand the effect finally, fully, of what it is she said.
Your husband, the actor David Dukes, died of a heart attack last October. This was after you had completed the novel, but before it was published.
Yes.
Had he been sick, was this totally out of the blue?
It was totally out of the blue. Not only was it totally out of the blue, there is a coincidence involved. He dropped dead of a heart attack on a tennis court. The character in my novel who dies at the beginning, the husband who's told to die and who drops dead, dies of a heart attack on a tennis court. The same death, in quotes, the same death, you know. My husband looked great. He was in great shape. He, presumably in great shape. He played tennis, obviously. He played handball. He was a very active member of the acting profession. And in fact, he was shooting a miniseries in Seattle-Tacoma area called Rose Red, based on a Stephen King novel. And he had been home to visit us in Los Angeles that weekend. And he flew up to Seattle-Tacoma to shoot the next day and went out to play tennis that night and dropped dead. And we got the call later that night, but we had no inkling at all that he had coronary artery disease, which is what turned out he had. When I started the novel way back in 1994, had always been my first reader. As an actor, he had a great ear for dialogue, and he always read it and told me if he thought conversations worked or not. I even remember asking him if he thought, because he was such an avid tennis player, that a character could succumb on the tennis court, could actually die playing tennis. And he said, "Oh yeah, it's very intense cardiovascular exercise." It was a shock in so many ways that it's really hard to go back to that moment when I received that phone call and sort of or get any sense of what I felt in retrospect. But at first I was just in shock, and then later that evening I realized, my God, he's essentially died the same death as this character. I called my publisher, I called Random House at some point in the next few days, and I talked to Dan Miniker, my editor, and he said, I said I'd like to, you know, not publish the book. I just don't think I can do it. And he said, Dan said, just take a little while and think about it. And he was very smart to say that. He said Random House would do whatever I wanted them to do, but that he thought I should take a little time and think about it. So during that week, that horrible week when we were getting ready for the funeral and the rest of it, I did try to think about it a little. And I realized that because David had been so supportive, because he had been my reader, because he loved the idea of the novel, that I should publish it. He had asked to take it with him on the plane the day he left, and the very last version of it, the one I was about to send in to the copy editor, in fact, that day, and did send, he asked to read it and then said, no, I'll be back on Thursday, I'll read it then. So I knew I'd have to publish it, and that he would have wanted me to, but I was terrified of the reaction of the public. I just thought, you know, people would ask a lot of questions that would make me feel really badly.
Well, I guess I'll be asking some of those questions.
That's okay. So. I've gotten past that, I want to say.
Me. Okay, good, good. You know, I was actually wondering if you were afraid that, you know, to some superstition that there was some connection between you imagining a character's husband's death
right,
and your own
right.
husband dying.
Right. Well, of course, you know, that was the first thing I thought. You know, I mean, you just... you're in shock, as I said, but there's also this kind of magical thinking, that primitive thinking that has taken over your brain. And I thought, oh, yes, I caused his death in some way by writing this. I soon got over that, but I realized that, I don't know how to, this is the hard part to talk about it. Two things. One, this is where writers live, kind of, when they write. I think they kind of map this uncharted terrain of coincidence and dream and... serendipity, right? That this is where we live as fiction writers. That, you know, maybe Kafka, in writing The Penal Colony, prefigured the Holocaust. You know, maybe Carlos Fuentes, who possibly wrote about the death of a son, prefigured his son's death. But to say that the writer caused it, no. I just think that we know what we don't know when we write often, and that we use material, of course, from our lives as writers, but then that material becomes transformed, clearly. It becomes something else, and it changes. And I found that when I thought about it finally, when I could think about this coincidence a little more clearly, I realized that that was true, that that was where... I had been as a writer in that uncharted terrain, but also that this thing that happened fed sort of naturally into a passionate belief of my own that we're not as hooked into the imagination in our public consciousness as we used to be anymore. In other words, we love memoirs, we love real-life TV, we love It Really Happened Like This kinds of testimonies. And as soon as someone publishes a novel, the assumption is always made, well, you know, it's got to be, you know, It's got to be, this has to be about, you know, this person's family or lover or adulterous affair or whatever. You know, that there's psychobiography, these reading of characters. It's even done in retrospect after people die. So I thought this is a chance to talk about how fiction does transform things and how when we make things up, we truly do write something that never existed before.
Well, I'm wondering what your husband was thinking when he read the manuscript, which is about a wife who's so irritated with her husband, so angry with him, that she basically tells him to drop dead.
Yeah.
Did he want to be reassured that this wasn't some hostility
no.
that you were
no.
harboring against
no.
him?
No, I'm glad you asked that, actually. Well, this is not, first of all, yes, I mean, every marriage has, I truly believe that people do tell each other to drop dead, you know, and that happens in marriages, and I think they say worse things. I think people argue and fight and there's anger and it goes on, and that's part of life. But he was a real believer in what I just was talking about, the transformational power of art. He also, he was an actor who was trained classically, and he was considered himself part of a kind of dying breed, not to make a terrible pun, but of actor, one who was more interested finally in in representation, not so much in representation, but in making something come alive on stage that had never been there before. He was trained at ACT in San Francisco. His first play on Broadway was Molière's School for Wives. And he came out of rep, you know, came out of that really stringent training in the classics and a kind of acting that, in a way, we don't see so much of anymore. He believed that a lot had happened to change acting so that it had become much more, quotes, realistic, not just film and TV acting in general, that people really had no more or less use for those gestures, those profound transformational moments in acting. So he always read fiction as fiction, and he was a staunch defender of that difference. But again, that's not to say that, you know, he didn't pick up on what might have been, again, you know, a moment from our lives. Apart from the anger that's always in a marriage, I think that there also, in my case, was, when I think back, there were some signs that he might not have been as healthy as we thought. I remember seeing him look tired. I remember seeing a shadow across his face. I remember sitting next to him in bed once when we were both reading and his heart was beating really, really strongly. And I said, "Why is your heart beating like that so powerfully?" And he said, I got a good, strong heart. But in fact, it wasn't. It was, if I had just, you know, channeled my inquiry a different way, I would have realized, well, his heart at rest shouldn't be beating like that, you know. But what I did was, I think now, and this is the part that gets so tricky in terms of art and life, but I think what I did was maybe put that inquiry into art. In other words, the character that I was creating perhaps became the repository of some of my concern. If I had said to David, my husband, "You need to go to the doctor right away," he would never have gone. He had to believe he was healthy, you know.
Right.
My guest is novelist and poet Carol Muskie Dukes. Her new novel is called Life After Death. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is poet and novelist Carol Muskie Dukes. Her new novel is called Life After Death. For your novel Life After Death, you imagined what a wife might experience when her husband died. And then right after you finished the novel, you experienced your husband's death.
Mm-hmm.
After some time had elapsed and you were able to think a little bit about the book again, were there things that no longer rang true where you said to yourself, Now that I've really lived through this kind of grief,
yeah,
I have to make certain changes.
Well, it was too late to make changes. The book was already almost ready to be printed when my husband died. But I think that's a very good question because, in fact, I thought, wow, you know, I thought I understood grief. I thought I understood death, and I think I did an okay job of describing a certain person's grief, but I think I would write it a little bit differently. You know, I even thought I'd been so arrogant for so long. I'm a poet, for Pete's sake. You know, this is what poets write about, death, right? Keats, you know, we're half in love with easeful death. But I realized I had been looking at death in a way which was much more abstract, obviously. I think now I would change things about the novel. I think that I would make her shock more pronounced because it is so disorienting to go through this. You don't know where you are in the solar system. You don't know who you are. You have to really just find a way to relocate yourself in every way. I don't think that I really portrayed that as powerfully as I don't think I put that in at all, really, to the extent that I would now. And I think I would also include more about how, although there's some reference to this in the novel now, but I think I would include more about how ideas of death are imposed upon you from the moment you lose somebody. You know, the state's idea, they're very possessive ideas, by the way. You know, the state's idea of death, in David's case, he died in Washington State, and he didn't have a physician at the ready up there. So I unfortunately they took a place called the Pierce County Medical Examiner's Office, took his body away from the hospital where he died and in the emergency room, and they refused to let my daughter and me fly up to Seattle and see the body. They did an autopsy without my approval. But so the state can do whatever, impose whatever idea of death. You get religious input. You get lots of feedback from individuals, from the funeral industry, I found myself in the extraordinary position of sitting at Forest Lawn, you know, talking to these representatives of the funeral home. They were saying things essentially from my novel. You know, I knew exactly what they were going to say before they said it. I knew what euphemisms they were going to use, the slumber room and so on. And all of that, I think I would heighten, because I think all those imposed ideas are really what people don't know about death, that you, in a way, can't possess the experience yourself unless you really fight to do it.
There's a poem that you have not yet published, but that I'd like you to read, that relates to exactly the sentiments you're talking about. It's called When He Fell, and it's in part about, you know, the state taking over the death and you being sidelined. Would you read that for us?
Sure. When he fell. When he fell, strangers ran to him. Strangers called for help, lifted his body and carried it. Then strangers cut him, emptied him. Their ideas of death determined when I would touch him again. Their ideas of death closed door after door between us, altered his face, altered his presence, violated the contract, the marriage, took away even his wounded heart. When he was at last delivered to me, I was no longer myself, just as he was no longer within identity. They had taken everything from us, authority, everywhere I turned. Just as he and I once thought we were authorities over our own lives, our work, our sense of mortality, imagination. Oh, and that sense of loss that predicated everything. You know, what we called our personal lives.
Thanks for reading that.
Sure.
When did you write that poem?
I wrote that poem, I think about, it must have been 2 or 3 months after he died. When he first died, I couldn't write at all. I didn't think I'd ever write another line. I couldn't even read. And then after, it must have been about a month and a half, 2 months, I just woke up one night and started writing, and about, I mean, this sounds crazy, but about 7, 8, 9 poems just flowed onto paper, and I've never had that experience before. So obviously, I've been harboring these poems in my unconscious, and since then, I've been able to work on them some more. So this one's about that old.
You know, you were saying that the people at the cemetery and the mortuary were using all the kind of lingo that you make fun of in your book,
yeah.
And all that kind of euphemistic business language surrounding death. And I'm sure, well, I'm wondering if the things that you learned about cemeteries and funeral homes as research for your book came in of any help at all, either emotionally or just on the business end of just getting through the administrative and business aspects of death.
Well, I think it did help. I mean, again, you know, I have to say, when you go through this, these people get you at a moment when, I hate to say get you, but, you know, the funeral industry gets you at a moment as a survivor when you're really vulnerable, obviously. You're in shock, as I said. You're very susceptible at that point to all kinds of suggestions about, you know, what kind of burial decorative and you know, what kind of imagination you should have to use in putting together a funeral service. But, you know, so people end up, I think, victimized by this whole industry. But I was able to be, even in my shock, I think I was pretty clear on what was happening most of the time. It did allow me to have some rudder through this whole process. Even my knowing didn't really prevent what finally is, I think, pretty typical. You know, there are a lot of things go wrong for people who are survivors, you know, and they can't do much about it. Plus, you're not in a state to fight. I mean, you're not in a condition to want to fight back. And I think most people just give up because they're mourning.
In your poem, you write that their ideas of death closed door after door between us, altered his face, altered mm-hmm. his presence.
Yeah.
So you didn't get to see your husband's body until
no.
after it had been altered by, what, the restoration expert and after the autopsy and all that?
Well, this is kind of grisly, but when my daughter and I were denied access to his body, to just holding him, you know, in the moments after his death, we also were essentially kept from the whole series of things that happened from that point on, and having control over them, that is to say, I mentioned the autopsy. He had an autopsy as required by state law, I guess. We were told that we couldn't see him, and that was state law. That turned out not to be true. That was a false statement made by this medical examiner's office. But in fact, I think the autopsy may be state law. In any case, it was done before his body could be flown back to Los Angeles. It had to be embalmed, and it went to the medical examiner's office, local coroner, or local embalming, funeral home. And they did a very poor job, that would be putting it mildly. And so when Forest Lawn received the body in Los Angeles, they didn't want me to see it, but I did. My sister-in-law and I went in and looked at it, and it was clear then that major... further restoration had to be done, and Forest Lawn did do that, and they did a fairly good job, but he never looked like himself again. He didn't look like himself to me when I saw him.
Carol Muskie-Dukes will be back in the second half of the show. Her new novel is called Life After Death. She's the director of the graduate program in literature and creative writing at the University of Southern California. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with poet and novelist Carol Muskie-Dukes. Her new novel, Life After Death, begins as a woman tells her husband, in anger, to drop dead. The next day, he dies of a heart attack. Shortly after she completed the novel, Carol Muskie-Dukes lost her own husband to a heart attack. Her husband, David Dukes, was an actor. He was away from home on location when he died. She wasn't allowed to see him until after his body was autopsied and embalmed. So when you got to see your husband's body, he had already had the autopsy and restoration work, and you were very unhappy with the work that was done. And you didn't think it looked like him. The scary thing about that is, like, it's your last memory.
Mm-hmm.
Did you worry about how much that memory would stick and maybe, at least for the short term, overpower your other memories of how he looked?
Well, yes. I worried about it particularly for my daughter, too, because, the last time she saw him, he looked wonderful. He was going out the door with his sort of briefcase thing over his back, and he was in his little suitcase, and he was being picked up by a car to go to the airport, and he had he just looked great. He had been home to see her for a dad-daughter picnic at her school, and then suddenly there's this sort of strange, whatever it is, figure, that's there. We did have an open casket, but one really good thing was that because he was an actor, there were many actors and directors and people who were in the industry who spoke at his funeral. And the actors made him come alive again in a way. The statements, the eulogies at the service were so incredibly emotive and powerful there was a sense of him almost standing up and standing before us. It was I can't describe it. It was quite extraordinary. John Lithgow, who's a very good friend of David's and mine, spoke at the funeral, and he, for example, read the speech from Midsummer Night's Dream about Let Me Play the Lions Part 2, which was a favorite of David's, and he read it at the end of the funeral and then turned and said, let him roar again, let him roar again, and face the coffin. And everyone stood up spontaneously, 600 people, and gave David a standing ovation. So it really was as if he lived again. So that, I was very grateful that my daughter and everyone there, my stepson and myself, all of us had that moment.
As a poet who's always, writing about your real feelings and your imagined projections of other people's feelings, what was it like living with an actor who was always becoming somebody else?
Well, it's a very difficult life, I have to say. Not just because of that, because actors are away a lot. They're gone a lot of the time because their roles take them, everywhere. My daughter's traveled all over the world, really, essentially, because we've visited him. She's either gone to writers' conferences with me everywhere, gone with him on location, we're the two of us on location, to all kinds of places. But besides being physically away a lot, they're also often not there when they're inhabiting a role. And that's a very peculiar phenomenon, that level of distraction there's a certain distraction, obviously, that is part of writing, but the acting distraction, I think, is much more a kind of proactive psychosis. But it's not, you know, it doesn't spill over into everyday life, but you certainly have a sense of it, of that rumination going on. And then when they're not working, when actors aren't working, they tend to be a little depressed. So it's a very tough life in terms of someone really being there, you know, really being present all the time, day to day. But David was very good at, he was a family man for all that, and he was a very good father. And he was, you know, he found a way to sort of, to try to balance these things.
You said that your mother was a frustrated poet. What was her poetry like?
My mother had six children. She was born in North Dakota in a tiny little town called Winemere. And she was born during the Depression, or actually, no, she grew up during the Depression. She was born much earlier, and she could have gone to college, had scholarships, but even with that, her parents didn't have enough money to send her. So anyway, she couldn't become what she wanted to become, which was a poet. So what she did was, she came out of that generation that memorized pages and pages and pages of poetry. She knew volumes by heart. So what she would do is recite poetry to us as children. But she'd add her own little commentary. She's usually yelling at one of the kids, so she would recite something like, "Let me not to the marriage of true minds. Put that down right now. Admit impediment." And before I could, you know, I used to hear this stuff before I could read, and when I went to school and finally read, you know, Sonnet 116 or whatever, I finally got old enough to read the sonnet, I thought, where's the part about put that down right now, or put the dishes in the sink, right? So she, my mother had this kind of strange relationship with poetry that she made it her own in a way. She wrote in the margin and then made the margin part of the poem, and I will remember her voice forever. I think I became a poet because I will hear that voice forever, and she loved poetry so much. And never really tried to write it herself, but did sort of edit it in that way. But, you know, like I said, she came out of that generation that learned for declamation, as they called it, and it was wonderful, powerful stuff. I mean, they learned pages of poetry, and that poetry ran in their veins. They could recite at the drop of the hat. They owned those words, so that it was okay that she kind of inflected them the way that she did and trampled the rhyme, as I said. It was okay. Those poems belonged to her. They gave her sustenance. And I think my mother's generation maybe was the last generation. You know, they out in the prairie, they had those Harvard classics, and they learned those poems. They learned their Tennyson and their Wordsworth and their Milton and, you know, their Emily Dickinson.
Was there ever a time as a girl where you both liked and were irritated by those poems, that there was something you liked about them, but you didn't like her declaiming poetry at you?
Oh, I thought it was very embarrassing, you know. I mean, there wasn't anything you could do without my mother coming up with a poem to comment on it. You know, how like, what is that from Shakespeare? How like a serpent's tooth, an ungrateful child. You know, I mean, everything had its little punctuation in poetry. Yeah, it was very irritating, but also obviously very instructive.
So you both were irritated and inspired at the same time?
Exactly. It's the way, I mean, can you imagine? It's hard enough to have your mother on your case, you know, I think. It's hard enough for, you know, we all have our issues with our mothers, I think, as we grow up and they instruct us. But to have the additional weight of the ages in poetry, I think, is a particular burden.
Is there a poem she used to recite for you that you still really love?
Well, there's a reference to "They also serve who only stand and wait," right? I mean, she would often recite Milton's sonnet on his blindness. That was really a great favorite of hers, and it's a very moving poem if you go back and look at it, because it's a real kind of acceptance of one's fate in the universe, and yet an argument, you know, which was very much her. She would argue and then tend to accept fate. So I, you know, apart from her Catholicism, I think I got a sense of the sense of the universe as having an order. I also was in love with the Latin from the Latin Mass. I mean, I go so far back that there was actually Latin being recited as part of the daily Mass or whatever in church. And I remember, before I ever understood Latin, hearing those rolling syllables and connecting it to my mother, and that same sort of love of words and the music of words. Bob Haas once said to me, Robert Haas said, a poet as you know, who said to me, we're lucky to have grown up Catholic because look at the mystery of the liturgy. You know, we got all that music, all that mystery, those, you know, priests and vestments and incense and censers and Latin, you know. It's a great boon for a poet. And I think that's probably true.
My guest is novelist and poet Carol Muskie Dukes. Her new novel is called Life After Death. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is poet and novelist Carol Muskie Dukes. Her new novel is called Life After Death. You've taught literature at several universities, but you also taught writing or poetry at Rikers Island, a prison in New York. What got you to teach writing in prison?
Well, I was always interested in prisons. I'm not exactly sure why. I just remember when I was, this goes way back, I was driving with my father when I was a really little girl in Minnesota, and we used to go out for rides every night, and he would sing to me. He loved country western music, and he would sing, and I'd be listening to this incredible music, and I remember him singing a song. I don't know whose song this is, if it's Hank Williams or somebody's, but it's, "If I Had the Wings of an Angel Over These Prison Walls, I Would Fly. I'd fly straight to the arms of my darling, and there I'd be willing to die." And I remember driving around Stillwater once with him, and he was singing this song, and just as he started to sing the song, the great gray wall of the Stillwater prison, which is a state prison in Minnesota, in a little town called Stillwater, rose up before us, and I had such a sense of, you know, the pathos of the prisoners, and it stayed with me my whole life. And I felt, you know, I was very moved by Attica, which took place in 1972. I was living in New York. When I started teaching at Columbia in the graduate writing program, as I said, I felt very much as if I was in a kind of rarefied atmosphere, and I wanted to be able to balance that in some way. So I began teaching out at, I started teaching out at the Women's House on Rikers Island, Women's House of Detention. And the program, you know, it was very popular, actually. We ended up with, you know, not just classes in poetry, but in fiction and playwriting and so on. And the program spread throughout the state. It was called Art Without Walls, and I think it still goes on. But it was for me, it was an incredibly enlightening experience because I found that there are people who wrote, just as we were talking about in the beginning, about language having a kind of connection, a responsibility in language, let's say, the precision of language and the sense of language really connecting in some way to one's life. I had the sense of that teaching working with these women because they wrote more or less to stay sane, you know, to order their lives in a way. They wrote this narrative that allowed them, poetry or prose, but allowed them to continue as human beings. And that was very instructive.
I'd like to have you leave us with a poem, and this is another poem about your husband's death, specifically about getting the call that he was dying. The poem is called The Call. Would you introduce it for us and then read it?
Yeah, thank you. It's a poem that was very hard to write, but it was the first poem that came out when I spoke about the poem sort of flowing suddenly after his death. This one came first, and it really is pretty simple in terms of its situation, and yet profound. It's a call that I received on the phone from someone telling me there'd been an accident, giving me a number of an emergency room, which I then called. My husband had been taken to this emergency room. At the emergency room at the hospital, a nurse finally, no one would talk to me or tell me what had happened. Finally, a nurse told me that she would tell me exactly what was going on, but I had to be prepared for the fact that it was very grim. The situation was grim. And so my daughter was standing next to me, my 17-year-old daughter, and I said to her, "Do we want to hear this?" Because I was going to repeat what this nurse said as it was given to me. And my daughter said, "Yes, we want to hear it." And so it proceeded. The nurse told us more or less, blow by blow, step by step, what was happening to him as he died and as she watched him die. The call. When I heard the voice on the telephone telling me there'd been an accident, I repeated my question twice without receiving an answer. I was given another number, and at that number I asked again without response. At last someone took pity on me, a nurse in that distant room, beginning now to take shape before my eyes, paused, then put my question back to me. Did I want to be told what was happening to you? I looked at my daughter, poised next to me, waiting, her hand over her mouth. She inclined her head. I do, I said, like a bride. I heard the woman's quick intake of breath, her voice rising only slightly, as she called out to me, step by step, precisely how your body failed, as she watched it fail before her. I held the phone to my ear, repeating each of these answers to my question, so that images of you, disappearing, appeared in the air of the kitchen where we stood. The dishes in the sink, the stove, my daughter's gaze, then yours, superimposed over hers, your eyes wide in that other room where you lay, rapidly dying beyond the open receiver. The shouting technicians hovering over your body, the emergency room's echo beyond the monotone in my ear, blood pressure, pulse rate, respiration. The soul, quietly differing, repeating my question, but ringed with burning images, the final answers, given unflinching from faith, from terror, from all we could never know about you.
This poem seems so much more emotionally direct in a way than some of your other writing. You know what I mean? It's just...
Yeah.
Did you find yourself just writing in a different kind of voice?
Well, yeah, I did. And that's why, you know, I'm not sure if these new poems are really poems. I think that they are. What I mean when I say I'm not sure they're poems is that I think that they seem... So clearly they're autobiographical. Clearly they are documents, in a way, of an experience. But I hope that they transform themselves into poetry. I think they do, and it's a whole new kind of writing for me. You're right. I mean, it is much more direct. I've been much more abstract in my poetry before. That's much more, I think, indicative, you know, indicating rather than actually stating often. And this is just, I had no control over this. It just sort of came out this way. As I said, I don't mean to say I, you know, took notes from the muse, but I had a sense of the inevitability of the line that perhaps I haven't had before in my writing. So I'm not sure where that's going, but I feel it's been, you know, it's been a comfort in a way, in an odd way, not a comfort, but a sort of enormous clarification, which is helpful. That process of clearing one's mind and understanding what's happening in the process of writing. The world will never make sense, but things will become clear in this way, I think, for me.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Carol Muskie Duke's new novel is called Life After Death. She's the director of the graduate program in literature and creative writing at the University of Southern California. This is Fresh Air.